Good morning, everyone, and thank you, Chris. And I am optimistic because I'm incredibly grateful that we live in this fantastic country. We enjoy a prosperous and successful economy, and we have a lot to be thankful for. We've had to live through these crises, but where else in the world would you want to live through them but Australia? I'm also very grateful to be here in person. This is the first business trip to Melbourne that I've had since COVID, so it's really good to be back here after a long break. This forum is being held at a very critical time. I say that because as a country, we do face some very significant challenges, but we have plenty of opportunities as well. This morning, I would like to talk mainly about the challenge of bringing inflation back to target. It's a really important priority for the RBA. And in the spirit of this forum being about strategic issues, I'd also like to briefly touch on two strategic issues that are important to the Reserve Bank. The first is the need to lift productivity growth in Australia, and the second is the changing nature of money in our society. But first to inflation. After many years in which inflation was something that most people didn't have to think or worry about, it's now a topic of everyday conversation. It's understandable as higher prices are really putting pressure on people's budgets. As you can see in my first chart here, in many countries, inflation is now running at the highest rate in years. In the United States and Europe, inflation is close to 10%. It's remarkable. The last time that inflation was close to this mark was in the early 1980s. I think many of us had thought that we wouldn't see those type of inflation rates again in the advanced economies. In Australia, the latest available reading for the CPI is for the March quarter. It's quite a long time ago. As you can see in this next chart, the inflation rate to the March quarter was 5.1%. This is lower than it was in most other countries, but it's higher than it has been for quite some years, and it's higher than we were expecting. The CPI for the June quarter will be released next week, and it will show a further step up in the rate of inflation in Australia, and we'll see another step up again later in the year. And the Reserve Bank will be publishing a full set of forecasts in early August with a statement of monetary policy. The policy challenge for the RBA is to return inflation to the 2 to 3% range while at the same time keeping the economy on an even keel. We don't need to return inflation to target immediately, as we have long had, for very good reasons, a flexible medium-term inflation target. But we do need to chart a credible path back to 2 to 3%. We're seeking to do this in a way in which the economy continues to grow and unemployment stays low. It's certainly possible to do this, but the path ahead is a narrow one and it's clouded in uncertainty. Global factors, including Russia's invasion of Ukraine, are one source of this uncertainty. And domestically, the path back to 2 to 3% inflation will be shaped by how the general inflation psychology evolves in Australia and how Australians respond to the higher interest rates. So these are some of the issues that we'll be watching very carefully over the months ahead. In charting the path back to 2 to 3% inflation, it's really useful to understand the origins of the current higher bout of inflation. And there are three factors that I'd like to point to. The first is the major interruptions to global supply chains that occurred along a surge in demand for goods as people switched their expenditure patterns from services to goods during the pandemic. And you can see this switch in expenditure patterns in this chart. Very strong demand for goods and weak demand for services. As we all know, global supply chains are very long, and any interruption anywhere along the chain has a ripple effect right through the chain. And the resulting disruptions have increased firms' costs. They've constrained their ability to respond to this change in expenditure patterns, which you can see in this chart. The inevitable result of strong demand and problems on the supply side has been higher prices for goods in global markets. The second factor is Russia's invasion of Ukraine. As we know, this has caused major disruptions in the global markets for energy and for food. And this has directly affected CPI inflation in all countries, and there are now second-round effects apparent as higher energy costs feed into higher costs of transportation and production. The third factor is the surprising strength of demand in many economies. Household spending in particular has recovered very quickly from the pandemic. I think this reflects the combination of the successful vaccination campaigns and the unprecedented support for household finances from monetary and fiscal policy. This policy support meant that as the health situation improved, households had the confidence and, importantly, the ability to spend. The result has been very strong growth in aggregate demand and the emergence of tight labour markets in many countries, including here in Australia. The result has been higher inflation. Looking back at this experience with hindsight, I can understand why some people might conclude that too much support was provided by governments and by central banks. But it's really important to remember the context in which these decisions were made. At the time the decisions were made to provide this support, the outlook was truly dire. In Australia, tens of thousands of people were expected to die. Our hospitals were expected to be overflowing. Many people were expected to lose their jobs. And we were expecting deep social and economic scarring. And it was a really scary time. In this environment, the Reserve Bank had a very strong insurance mindset. Many other central banks and governments had a similar mindset. In our case, we wanted to do what we could to provide insurance for Australians against the potentially catastrophic economic consequences of the pandemic. With the benefit of hindsight, it could be argued that we took out too much insurance. But that's the nature of insurance, isn't it? If the event that you're insuring against occurs, you're really glad you're fully insured. But if the event doesn't occur, you're left questioning your decision and wondering whether you could have saved some money. That's the nature of insurance. Understandably, judgments will differ as to whether we overinsured or not. But in the highly uncertain environment of the time, the right policy choice was to err on the side of too much insurance rather than too little insurance. I recognise, though, that while this approach helped avoid some of the damaging long-term scarring, it has contributed to the inflation pressures we're now experiencing. We're having to respond to that now. Looking forward, the path back to 2-3% inflation requires an increase in supply and some moderation in demand. In terms of the supply side, there is a reasonable basis to expect that the COVID-related disruptions to global supply chains will be resolved. Delivery times are now improving, and some supply bottlenecks are easing as firms adjust to the new operating environment. The effect of this and some rebalancing in consumer demand is now evident in global markets. You can see here that there have been recent price declines in products as diverse as computer chips and timber. This reflects moderation in global demand and some easing of the supply problems in global markets. More broadly, the prices of many commodities have also declined over the past few weeks after the sharp increases following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. As you can see in this chart, oil and wheat prices have fallen recently, and as have the prices of many of the base metals. These declines reflect the increased concerns about the strength of the global economy and some easing of the supply problems. If these lower prices are sustained, this will ease some of the current pressure on global inflation. Even so, it does remain possible that we'll see further interruptions to global supply. We've seen a lot over the past few years, and we can't rule out further interruptions. But if we don't have those interruptions, some of the global inflation pressures in the economy will start to dissipate. On the domestic demand side, the economy has bounced back very strongly from the Omicron setback in January. And this is really strongly evident in the labour market, where the results have been remarkable. Full-time employment is now 7% above its pre-pandemic level, and the unemployment rate has declined to 3.5%. It's the lowest rate in nearly 50 years, and it was a rate that we didn't expect to see in the near term in Australia. Underemployment has also declined in recent months, and job vacancies are at historically high levels in almost every industry. This all suggests that growth in demand in the Australian economy is pushing up against the capacity of the economy to meet that demand. For inflation to return to the 2-3% target range, a more sustainable balance between demand and supply is needed in our economy. And higher interest rates will help achieve this through moderating growth in aggregate demand. With the COVID emergency now over, so too is the time for emergency settings of monetary policy. The Reserve Bank was patient in withdrawing the insurance that was put in place during the pandemic. We wanted to ensure a robust recovery, and we were very aware that our main policy instrument, the cash rate, was at the effective lower bound. But that robust recovery has now taken place, and the time for ultra-low interest rates is now behind us, given that inflation is as high as it is and the labour market is very tight. In light of this assessment, the Reserve Bank has increased the cash rate by 125 basis points over the past three meetings, with the cash rate now standing at 1.35%, and we expect further increases will be required in the cash rate over the months ahead. And these increases will help establish a more sustainable balance between demand and supply in our economy. In considering the outlook for interest rates at its most recent meeting, the board had an extended conversation about the neutral real interest rate. The concept of the neutral real rate is a useful one. It's the interest rate that's neither stimulatory or contractionary for the economy. From a practical perspective, though, one of the challenges we face is that the neutral real interest rate can't be observed or it can't be measured directly. So it must be estimated or inferred from other information, and the staff at the RBA use a wide range of models and techniques to do this. These models produce a range of estimates, and the estimates change through time as more information becomes available. This means that there is considerable uncertainty around any particular estimate of the neutral real interest rate. Having said that, most approaches suggest that the neutral real rate for Australia is at least positive. A related challenge is that the board needs to translate any estimate of the neutral real interest rate into an estimate of the neutral nominal rate, as we set the nominal interest rate, not the real rate. This translation from real to nominal requires an estimate of expected inflation. If we take the midpoint of the inflation targeting range of 2.5% as a reasonable estimate of medium-term inflation expectations, this suggests that the neutral nominal rate in Australia is at least 2.5%, and it would be higher than this if medium-term inflation expectations were to shift higher. I want to emphasise, though, that the concept of a neutral rate is no more than one reference point for the board. It isn't the basis of a mechanical rule, and we are not on a preset path to achieve any specific level of the cash rate. Rather, the board will continue to be guided by the incoming evidence and its assessment of the outlook for inflation and the labour market, and we are determined to do what's necessary to bring inflation back to 2-3% over time. As I indicated earlier, an important consideration is how inflation expectations and the general inflation psychology in the community evolve. If inflation expectations were to shift up, and businesses and workers were to expect higher rates of inflation on an ongoing basis, it will be harder, much harder, to get inflation to return to target. Doing so would require higher interest rates, and it would require a sharp slowing in spending. And it's in our collective interest that this doesn't happen. At the RBA, we track a wide range of measures of inflation expectations, including those derived from surveys and from financial prices. These various measures paint the same general picture: higher inflation expected for a short while before declining back to target. As an example, The measure of inflation expectations derived from inflation index swaps suggests a high degree of confidence in financial markets that the average inflation rate in Australia over the next 10 years will be 2 point something. These swaps also suggest that the average rate of inflation over the period between 1 and 5 years ahead will be in the 2 to 3% range as well. This assessment by financial markets that inflation is expected to return to the targets reassuring. But we're also paying close attention to the general inflation psychology in the country. If people setting prices and wages were to believe that higher inflation will persist, they're more likely to push prices and wages up. This could result in a self-reinforcing cycle, one in which higher inflation leads to firms being more willing to put their prices up and to agree to larger wage claims, which would then perpetuate the higher rate of inflation and the cycle would repeat itself. This is what happened in the 1970s, and it ended badly. There's little evidence of such a cycle at present, and it's important that this remains the case. The RBA is committed to ensuring that the current period of higher inflation is only temporary, and it will do what is necessary to bring inflation back to target. It'll be harder for us to do this if the inflation psychology in the country shifts. The other general factor that will shape the path back to 2 to 3% inflation is how households respond to the higher interest rates and the higher inflation. Household spending so far has been very resilient. It's been supported by household balance sheets that are in generally good shape, and it's been supported by the fact that people are getting jobs. As you can see in this next chart, the household saving rate is still higher than it was before the pandemic. This is quite different to the experience in most other countries where the saving rate has returned to where it was before the pandemic. Our saving rate is still high, and many households have also built up quite large financial buffers, including through payments into offset accounts. Over the past couple of years, households saved nearly $250 billion extra. That's a very large amount of money, and the current flow into savings is still higher than it was before the pandemic. But as my colleague Michelle Bullock discussed yesterday, not all households are alike. Recent borrowers and borrowers with lower incomes tend to have smaller buffers. It's also worth remembering that around two-thirds of households do not have a home loan. I think another significant influence on household spending in the period ahead is housing prices, which are now declining in many markets after very large run-ups over the past couple of years. So the situation is complex and there are many moving parts, and the board will be monitoring these moving parts very closely. But at the moment, household spending has been resilient and people are getting jobs. So I think there's a lot of resilience in the Australian economy and in household finances. I'd now like to turn briefly to the two other strategic issues that I mentioned at the outset. The first of these is the need to lift productivity growth. I raise this issue because many of the challenges we face together as a nation would be made easier by stronger growth in productivity. There is a limit to what can be achieved through demand management through monetary policy. The supply side matters too, and it matters increasingly. Stronger productivity growth means a bigger economic pie, and it means higher living standards. It can also put downward pressure on prices and on inflation. Stronger productivity growth also provides governments with a greater capability to fund the many services that the public values. And it is the only way to sustain stronger growth in real wages. And on the financial side, stronger productivity growth is likely to mean a higher neutral real interest rate and higher real asset values. So savers would receive higher returns as well, and our aggregate wealth would be higher. Unfortunately, recent trends in productivity growth have not been particularly encouraging. Over the decade to 2014, labour productivity growth in Australia averaged 1.2%, as you can see in this chart, and over recent times, while the data have been bumpy, average productivity growth has been slower. In contrast, labour productivity growth was in excess of 2% during much of the 1990s. There's been quite a slowing. A similar pattern is evident in many other advanced economies, and the underlying reasons for this are complex and they're not particularly well understood. The strategic challenge for us as a nation is to do what we reasonably can to lift our productivity growth, given all the advantages that I talked about that come from stronger productivity growth. I think the good news here is that there's no shortage of ideas on how to do this. The challenge we have is one of implementation. The other strategic issue they wanted to highlight is the future of money and the nature of the monetary system. A strong lesson from history is that what a society uses as money changes with technology. Once again, recent advances in technology are changing the nature of money in our society. Most money these days is digital, and it's able to be moved very quickly between bank accounts. In Australia, most people can move money between any two bank accounts in less than 10 seconds, any day of the week, any time of the day. It doesn't take the days that it once did. And on the horizon is the possibility of programmable money, which contains self-executing code that triggers a payment when a specified condition is met. Also on the horizon is the tokenisation of bank deposits, which could facilitate the tokenisation of other physical and financial assets. This in turn could unlock a wave of innovation and productivity growth across the financial services sector. A second lesson from history is that money works best when it's backed by the central bank or by the state. The backing by a central bank engenders trust. It encourages widespread acceptance, and it provides stability in times of stress. In the past, privately backed money has all too often ended in losses for investors and in financial instability. While I don't think of most of the crypto universe as money, the recent collapse of the Terra USD stablecoin serves as a reminder of this point. So the strategic issue here for central banks and governments is how to capitalise on the benefits of the new technologies and the new forms of monies, while at the same time preserving the stability and other benefits that come from a system underpinned by central banks. This is likely to require a strong regulatory regime to deal with payment stable coins and perhaps the central banks issuing a form of digital currency. These are important issues that we're working on closely with other regulators in Australia and other central banks around the world, given their potential to reshape our financial systems over time and to lift productivity growth. Before I finish, I would like to welcome the announcement today by the government of the details of the review of Australia's monetary policy arrangements and the Reserve Bank. The terms of reference are appropriate, and the government has appointed a first-class panel. The review is welcomed by the Reserve Bank Board and by the bank staff. It's an opportunity to take stock of our monetary policy arrangements and to make sure that they're fit for purposes for the challenges that lie ahead. We're looking forward to participating in the process and to listening and to learning from others. Thank you. Thank you very much for listening today and being here in this room. And I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you, Dr. Lowe. That was a really interesting speech. We've got some time for questions from the floor here. There's two microphones. There's one on that corner over there and one on that corner over there. We have one over here in the back.
Good morning. Daniel Ziffer, ABC News. Good morning, Dr. Lowe. The government's review is wide-ranging into almost every aspect of the bank. How can that not be an implicit criticism of essentially everything that is going on under your leadership, sir?
I don't view it in those terms at all. I think it's an entirely appropriate thing to do, to take stock of our monetary policy arrangements. I view this as a health check. We've been through a very difficult period. We've had to have unconventional monetary policy, and we're now going through a period of high inflation. So I think it's entirely appropriate for the government to take stock of Australia's monetary policy framework. It's something that we welcome. Other central banks have periodically reviewed their frameworks. We've done that internally, continuously, but it's, I think it's useful to do that in the public domain as well. So we very much welcome it.
Another question over here. Yep.
Hi, Hannah Wooten from the Fin Review. A lot of what you've said in your speech today is predicated on sticking to that 2 to 3% range, and that's something that this review says it's going to consider. What will you do if in 6 months it's you get this finding that says that actually needs revision or scrapping altogether?
Would we respond to the results of the review as they come in? I'd observe that in most other countries that have under-reviewed their inflation targeting arrangement, they've come to the conclusion that a flexible inflation target centred somewhere around the 2% mark is the best we can do. I don't want to prejudge the conclusions of the review, but I think that general conclusion that flexible medium-term inflation targeting is the right monetary policy framework, I think that's a pretty robust conclusion. If the review panel come to a different conclusion, we'd have to assess that and discuss it with the government at the time. But my view is that flexible inflation targeting, while it has some limitations, is the best monetary policy set of arrangements for Australia, and we'll look at how best to implement flexible medium-term inflation targeting, and the review will help us do that.
Any questions from guests on the floor? I haven't seen any hands up on this side. Up, there's one over here at the back. Yes, sir. Just if we can get someone to you. Andrea's coming right now.
Julian Rose from Morgan Stanley. Can you comment on the need to moderate demand when household savings is above normal now, when that would suggest almost the opposite, that there's a precautionary stance by households that are running the savings rate above normal? And secondly, can you comment on why the Fed and the Reserve Bank are trying to normalise rates and do quantitative tightening at the same time? Would seem that the market disruption from quantitative tightening might defeat the purpose of trying to normalise rates of interest. Thank you.
Yep. I don't see quantitative tightening as problematic in any way, and I don't think it's affecting financial markets. The path ahead has been pretty well laid out by both us and the Federal Reserve. Markets have adjusted to that, and I don't think it's a major consideration at the moment. The focus rightly now is very much on higher interest rates and how high interest rates need to go to bring inflation back to target. In terms of the first question, as you said, households are saving quite a lot at the moment. I think there is still a degree of cautiousness out there. We've been through some very large shocks over the past couple of years, we know. And so people are still a bit cautious, and they're facing the prospect of higher interest rates still. Even though they're cautious, the household spending is still pretty strong. The high-frequency data we track at the moment, even though consumer confidence has come back a bit, suggests spending right at the moment is strong. And the fact that people are getting jobs really helps. The best way for people to have confidence about their future is to have a job and be confident there'll be a job tomorrow. And the labour market is an incredibly positive story. We've wanted to get back to full employment for decades. We've struggled to do that. We're now pretty close. Maybe even we've gone past the point of full employment. But you know, the fact that people have jobs is a very positive thing for our society. I know it makes it hard for firms to recruit workers, but for the societies at large, people having jobs is a wonderful thing, and it gives people confidence to keep spending. And our task now is to bring inflation back to target while keeping the labour market reasonably firm. As I said in my prepared remarks, I think there is a path that we can do that, but it's a pretty narrow path. We're hoping to tread it carefully.
Okay, looking around for more hands up from the floor. One over here, thank you, sir.
Dr. Lowe, in regards to Australians' high level of savings, which are cushioning the effect of interest rate rises at the moment, given the RBA is guided by data which may have a lag to it, at what point does the RBA consider a pause in increased interest rates to allow that that data to filter through to see the effect on the economy before continuing?
Well, the key consideration in the outlook for interest rates is how confident are we that inflation will come back to 2 to 3% over time. So that's what we'll be focusing on. But we'll get a reading on inflation next week. That'll be important. And beyond that, we'll have to look at trends in spending and the inflation dynamics both in the global economy and the Australian economy. So I think in the next little while, we're going to need to have further increases in interest rates. Now, a cash rate of 1.35% in an economy with inflation that's soon be 6% and perhaps 7%, and with an unemployment rate of 3.5%. You know, we need higher interest rates. That level of interest rate is too low, and we're going through a process now of steadily increasing interest rates, and there's more of that to come. We've got to move away from these very low level of interest rates we had during the emergency. We took out a lot of insurance. We have to remove the insurance, and there's more work for us to do there. And we'll be guided by the outlook for inflation.
I've got a question over here.
Dr. Lowe, Marjorie Johnston. I'm thinking back to the 1980s when interest rates reached 17%, and I think commercial rates were around 23% in the early 80s as well. Now we've got a generation or several generations who have never experienced that climate. Even at 5%, that would be a shockwave for, I guess, for rates and the economy. Can you just comment on how you see that sort of landscape playing out this year and into 2023?
As I said in response to the previous question, we've got more interest rate increases to come. I think in 2.5% is our rough estimate, or at least 2.5% of the neutral rate. So at some point, I imagine rates will get to at least that level. How quickly we need to get there, and indeed whether we need to get there, will be determined by the inflation outlook. It is coming as a shock, as you say, to many people. Parts of the community are having to restrain their spending. That's unambiguously the case. We need some slowing in growth in aggregate demand. The current growth in aggregate demand is putting pressure on the capacity of the economy. Probably many of you in this room have stories about how hard it is to get workers. You're running up against capacity in the construction sector and in the food production system as well. So we need some moderation in aggregate demand and higher interest rates, even though many people don't like that as part of the way we do that. Let's just think of the alternative. If we don't have higher interest rates, then we're going to have higher inflation persist. Eventually that will have to be addressed, and we know how, from history, how that's addressed. It's addressed through much higher interest rates, not as high as the 70% you were talking about, but much higher interest rates and a sharp slowing in the economy. So the mindset we have is one of steady increases in interest rates now to forestall a persistent shift in inflation and inflation expectations. And by doing that, we can have a lower peak in interest rates and hopefully avoid the need for a sharp slowing in expenditure. It's better to have a modest slowing in expenditure at a time of full employment than a sharp slowing later on when inflation's much higher.
We've probably got time for, I think, one more question. Anyone else? A hand over here. Yes, sir. Someone's coming to you right now. 1 second.
Thank you, Dr. Lowe. Yassine from the University of Melbourne. Looking at the medium term, you were saying that you were looking at an inflation rate of 2 to 3% on average. Seeing that we're looking at 10% in many countries, and probably Australia is going to see similar increase in inflation, would part of that average be dictated because of in the next year or two in a recessionary, in a short recession that would create a deflationary pressure and lead to the RBA having difficulties maintaining their mandate of full employment.
You're right, inflation's high now, but it's more than plausible that it's going to come down globally in the next little while because, as I showed in some of those graphs, the commodity prices are no longer rising. In fact, they're coming down. And remember, inflation is the rate of change of prices. It's not the level of prices. So even if commodity prices stayed high, the rate of inflation in those commodity prices goes from very high to low. So, and if prices are coming down, it's obviously we're going to get negative price impacts. So we'll see some moderation inflation pressures because of what's going on the supply side now in the global economy. The critical issue that we're focusing on and other central banks are focusing on is what's going on with inflation expectations. Because if this period of high inflation feeds through into expectation, people expect it to continue, then they'll adjust their price and wage setting behaviour and it will continue. And if it continues, that will have to be met with higher interest rates and a sharper slowing in spending. So the critical issue that all central banks are focused on, and I was in Bali at the weekend with the Treasurer and talking to my colleagues, and this is the key issue, to keep inflation expectations anchored. If that doesn't happen, then we're going to have trouble returning inflation to 2 to 3% over any reasonable horizon. So, I was just saying financial markets at the moment say that inflation will come down, and I think the message to the community from the Reserve Bank and from other central banks is be confident that it will come down. We're going to do what's necessary to make sure that that happens.
One very quick question left. There's any hand left up, yep, just over here. Thank you. That'll be the last question.
Dr. Lowe, this is Rustin Saison. So I was wondering, you mentioned productivity as well, and I just wanted to ask if you have any recommendations. I know it's not directly the mandate of central banks, but if you have any recommendations for increasing productivity, that would be interesting to hear.
Yeah, as you say, it's not our responsibility, so I don't want to kind of advocate any specific policy because there are lots of good ideas. The challenge is one of implementation, but when people look at what we should be doing, the areas that they focus on are, I think, well known to you all, taxation, the balance we have in between taxing land, income, consumption, pollution. I think most people look at Australia's taxation system and say we haven't got the optimal balance there. There are issues in regulation of the labour market, energy production and distribution. I think we're going to talk about that later today. The way that government delivers services, particularly in the health sector, the way as a society we invest in human capital and the development of skills, particularly IT-related skills, the way we price and build infrastructure, the nature of our competition policy, and the way we design and manage our cities. So they're the areas where there are a lot of good ideas, and I don't want to advocate any specific idea in each of those areas because it's also contested. But there are a lot of things we can do here. It's a matter of choosing which ones we do and finding the political ability to do it. Let's hope we can do that, because there are lots of good opportunities here.
And let's look forward to those. Everyone, please thank Dr. Philip Lowe.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. And thank you so much for taking the time to take so many questions from the floor as well.